It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the latest from Capitol Hill, including the latest on an effort to require congressional approval for an Iranian nuclear agreement.
First, we're talking about the latest violence in Milwaukee after seven homicides were recorded in the city in a 48-hour period this week. Here's Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn responding to reporters on Tuesday about the number of homicides in the city.
Three of the lowest years we've had in the last 24 homicides have been during my administration. And you are right. We are on pace to be the highest, not only in my 7 or 8 years of being police chief here, but the highest in a number of years. And that is disturbing.
So far this year, the homicide total is at least 43. Last year at this time, there were only 14 recorded homicides. There have also been more charges from gun crimes in Milwaukee this year than in New York City, according to Mayor Tom Barrett.
James Causey is with us now to talk about the violence and what he thinks should be done about it. He's a columnist and blogger for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, first off, what kind of violence has Milwaukee seen so far this year?
I think the question is, what type of violence haven't we seen? I mean, there's been people beaten to death, shot, stabbed, run over by cars. You name it, we've seen it, and it's ridiculous.
Now, we heard that statistic. There are 43, at least, homicides so far this year compared to 14 homicides at this point last year. What do you make about that number?
Well, one thing I can say this is that a majority of the 43 victims are African American. I would say of that, overwhelming majority are African American men, and that should be troubling as well. What do I make of it? It's out of control. I mean, I know a lot of my friends, they just really don't go out anymore. They choose not to go out on a Friday and Saturday night, even to just go out to eat, because the streets have become so dangerous. And I think there's not one thing that you could blame it on. And I think people are looking for the silver bullet to blame it on one thing. Like, they could say it's a drug epidemic like heroin. Well, yeah, heroin is a problem, but that's one of our probably like 20 or 30 problems that's causing this outrage. I mean, there's mental illness, there's homelessness, there's hopelessness, there's poverty, there's too many guns, there's not a strong enough gun laws on the books to send people who commit these crimes to jail for a long time, or prison for a long time, after they have a gun and commit more crimes. I mean, it's a number of things. So you just can't point your finger at one thing and say, if we solve this, we could solve the problem. And I think that's what a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their hands around.
I want to see if we can put a face on some of the statistics, the stories that we see. Can you tell us about one or two of the people that Milwaukee lost to violence just in the last few days?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the one that stands out the most to me is this 2-year-old who was hit when he darted out in front of a van, and he was struck and killed. And then the person who struck this kid did the right thing. He actually got out of his van, and he held a child and he cried. He did what he was supposed to do by stopping. And his life was taken for stopping, because one of the 2-year-old's family members was so upset and outright insane, he goes and he shoots this man in the head, and in the process of firing his weapon, he kills the brother of the 2-year-old, a 15-year-old who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And now police are looking for this man. To me, no amount of police could have stopped this from happening. You want people to do the right thing after something tragic happens, and that's what this young man did. And this guy who stopped, he has children of his own. He has 4 daughters. He's a businessman. He was a man who worked in the community to try to build homes and places for homeless people to go. He was active as a community activist. He did all these things. And so not only is his family torn, but the community is torn. And I also feel sorry for the family of the 2-year-old, because how would you like to deal with the fact that, you know, you lost a 2-year-old and a 15-year-old, and the person who did this is a relative of yours. I mean, that, I don't know what type, what can you do to repair all of this? That's a lot of pain. That's a lot of anguish. And it's not a, that's not a police issue. That is a lot of different issues that need to be dealt with, from mental illness to too many guns. And the guy who allegedly did the shooting was a felon. He shouldn't even had a gun in the first place. So it's all of this kind of stuff going on, and it all took place, and that did not even need to happen. And that's the most troubling part, that it escalated to that point.
Tough losses for Milwaukee and at a personal and a community level. We're talking right now to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist James Causey about the violence in Milwaukee so far this year. We're at 43 homicides compared to 14 at this time last year. And James, you were talking about people who are afraid to go out on the weekend. They don't want to go out to dinner. Your piece, you talk about some people considering leaving Milwaukee because the streets are too dangerous. What does that tell you about the amount of attention being paid? I mean, this is a problem that has been ongoing. Right now, it's at a spike. But do you think that enough attention is being paid to this problem of violence within the African-American community?
I think enough attention is being paid to it because it's everywhere in the news, but I don't think the right resources are being directed towards it. So those are the two issues. I mean, you hear people often say, well, where's the protest? Where's the outrage? Because you hear outrage when police shoot and kill an African-American, and people say all this stuff. Well, you know, that's a whole separate issue, because we know that police tend to get off when they kill a black man, and that's a whole nother issue. But what's going on right now is that the people who commit these crimes, they eventually get caught. They eventually go to prison for a long, long time. But still, these families, the what happens after the shooting, I don't think enough takes place to try to heal these people after something like that takes place. And most, 9 times out of 10, you never heal from losing a kid. You never heal from losing a brother or a sister to gun violence. But this happens far too often. And as far as leaving the city, there's a friend of mine, Quavanon Anton Nixon, who does a lot in the community to try to address the pain and suffering of a lot of our African-American young men by talking to them and getting them to put their guns down. He said that, James, there's no utopia. It's no place that African-Americans could go where they could be away from this violence. And even if you do get to a point where you don't hear the gunshots anymore, you shouldn't forget that these gunshots are still taking place, and a lot of people are dying. Once you get to the point where you don't care anymore, then you don't tend to get back, have any skin in the game, and get back to help. And I think what we need, if we could talk about what needs to be done, we need people to quit talking about leaving. We need people to get involved. We need people to start talking to young people in schools. There's plenty of programs out here where these kids are suffering. They have no direction, and it's up to us to step in and get more involved. And I know people don't like to parent other people's children, but this is an opportunity where a lot of these young people are seeking a mentor, are seeking someone that they could turn to. And we could all step up. We could all do a little bit more. And that's one of the things that I dedicated myself to this year, to do more to help young people in need. And we all know someone like that. And if you don't know anybody like that, then all you have to do is come to Milwaukee and get involved in some of these programs at the Boys and Girls Club, at CYD, at a number of these organizations who could use the help.
Now, you mentioned earlier you think that there is enough attention being paid, but you think that the resources aren't being directed to the right places. You were just talking about youth mentorship. Any other resources that you think Milwaukee could use to help with this violence and point people toward healing?
Well, you know, you often hear that we need more police. I don't know if we necessarily need more police to address this issue. It would be nice to have more police, but let's just say, let's work with the police that we have. For instance, this guy, Ricky Ricardo Childs, is wanted for the assassination of a man who struck a 2-year-old and shooting a 15-year-old. and someone knows where he is. So someone should come forward and tell the police where this guy is. And he shouldn't be walking the streets, because no one is safe as long as a man with a gun who is a felon who has already killed two people is walking the streets. We could start with that. As far as other resources, I just think, you know, I talked to a friend about this the other day. We have no problem in spending like $30 or $40 or $50 or $60 going out to a bar and having drinks and a meal and stuff like that. But if there's like organizations around here that are doing things in communities and helping young people, and if they ask for $10, we turn our nose up like, oh, well, you need $10? You know, but what they do with their money and the people that they're reaching are people that we often forget about and don't talk about until they do something wrong. So I just think that we need to pool our resources and dollars and put them into programs that really get to the root causes of a lot of things that need to be talked about. And there's no better organizations out there than the ones that are directly impacting these kids' lives and getting them to put their guns down and talk about some of the pain and trauma that they have experienced. And when you see it firsthand, you realize that our kids have a lot of problems. They have a lot of issues that need to be dealt with, and we're not dealing with those issues. Until we deal with those issues, we're going to have more shootings.
And we're going to have to leave it there. James, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was James Causey, columnist and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We head to Washington for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. Yesterday, President Obama took a big step toward normalizing relations with Cuba by saying he'll take it off the state sponsors of terrorism list.
The president also backed down on his veto threat and will now approve a role for Congress in approving a nuclear agreement with Iran. Obama previously said he'd veto a bill mandating congressional approval, but after some influential Democrats joined Republicans in calling for a role, the White House changed course. Paul Singer joins us each Wednesday at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Well, let's start in Cuba, shall we? So taking it off the list of state sponsors of terrorism, Congress could, as I understand it, stop this if they wanted to. What are the chances of that happening?
I don't think very good at the moment. I mean, I think the taking Cuba off of the list of state sponsors of terrorism, the whole idea there is that's what opens up the opportunity for American businesses to begin to engage there. Our Florida reporter Alan Gomez has written about this. It's really smart, really smart analysis that. You know, Obama announced a bunch of liberalizing of trade with Cuba, but none of it could really take place until Cuba was off the state sponsor of terror, because businesses can't do business with countries on that list. So this is the thing, you know, when you sort of trigger that bureaucratic box by removing them from the list, then you can kick into action Obama's plan to improve relations with Cuba, and you'll see one of the reasons why I think that Congress will not get in the way of this part of it is that businesses are very, very interested in opening more trade with Cuba.
What's the response been like from Congress to this notion so far?
Well, it depends on what party you're in, largely. Republicans have been very opposed to it, particularly those who may be running for president have been very opposed to it. But there actually has been some bipartisan support. I think it was Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona, has been really at the lead of this effort, encouraging more open relations with Cuba. And keep in mind as well that you'll see a lot of interest in trade with Cuba, particularly from some of the agricultural states where you have Republican lawmakers, because, you know, we want to sell these people rice and other American products. So it's not necessarily a party line thing, honestly. And you will see that there will be a lot of support amongst Republicans for some liberalizing of trade. Now, when we get to the point of establishing an embassy, that might be a different matter. But certainly for the Republicans who are running for president, they see this as a bad idea, and folks like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, both with Cuban ancestry, they see this as selling out to a dictator.
And as you say, this is a big step, but one step among many toward normalization of relations with Cuba. Are there steps that a president couldn't go it alone on, that Congress would have to actively do something to take a next step?
Well, I'm pretty sure that there are still going to be sanctions that Congress will have to remove themselves, I believe. And of course, you know, if they were going to do anything like establish an embassy or appoint an ambassador, that would require Congress's involvement at some point. So I'm sure there are ways for Congress to get involved if they want to make an effort to obstruct this activity. I'm just not sure exactly where their hammer is. My suspicion is the closest they're going to be able to get for the near term is they could, in theory, prevent the lifting of any kind of sanctions.
Talking about the latest from Capitol Hill with Paul Singer from USA Today, and another big international story in Congress, one we've been tracking for some weeks now, negotiations with Iran. A big change there since the last time we talked about what's going on in Congress. What is new between Congress, the president, and Iran?
Yeah, the funny thing about what's new and the big change is that, basically members of two parties sat down and worked out a deal that was agreeable to both sides, which, is
just
kind of a landmark
itself,
achievement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. But the short version is, Obama, particularly with the backing of many Democrats, did not want Congress to essentially scuttle talks with Iran, these negotiations over Iran's nuclear program that have been progressing, but progressing more slowly, I think, than the administration was hoping, and deadlines have already begun to slip. What Congress has been saying, members of Congress in both parties have been saying, is, well, we would like an opportunity to review this deal. And there's a bunch of reasons why that's a complicating factor for the administration. Obviously, you can't negotiate a deal with another country and then come say, well, we have to go back to our Senate and make sure they'll approve it before it can be final. That makes it hard for another country to trust that America actually stands by what they're negotiating. And, of course, there was something about 47 senators, Republican senators, who wrote a letter to the Iranian leadership saying, don't trust Obama because he can't bring you a deal we can. So it was appearing to be just a very partisan spitting match. What they've managed to work out between Mr. Corker and Mr. Cardin, the top Republican and the top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee, is a timeline for Congress to have an opportunity to essentially say no to the deal. My understanding, and I'm not an expert in foreign policy, my understanding of the way this would work is that 30 days after a deal, Obama would be able to begin lifting the sanctions if Congress hasn't said no. And Congress will have an opportunity to vote, but Obama can't move until that 30-day period has lapsed. Then Congress gets an opportunity to vote. If they vote it down and they say, well, no, we're going to object to lifting the sanctions, then there is a process whereby Obama could override and a veto and stuff like that. So it basically just laid out a process that I think gives everyone a timetable, and a timetable where Obama can take action, he can negotiate a deal, and he can implement the deal. And I think it gives the administration some comfort that they have the time and the leeway to negotiate, and it gives Congress some comfort that they actually do have a say in this, and Obama's not going to just announce a deal and walk off without any kind of insight oversight from them.
Let's move on to elections 2016, not the presidential side, though that comes up here, but the race for the Senate, Democrats hoping to regain control. Marco Rubio running for president, meaning he's not running for Senate. So Florida, obviously off in a swing state. How's that the race going to shape up? Lots of people jumping in or announcing that they're not in already.
Yeah, it's going to be a circus. There will be the fun thing about Florida is, as you mentioned, as no doubt your
Disney World, right?
Will recall.
Oh, no, wait.
I mean, a lot of fun stuff always goes on in Florida. Presidential elections usually tilt on what happens in Florida, and having a competitive Senate race, of course, makes that even more exciting because now both parties are going to be activated on the ground. Both parties will be activated for their favorite candidates. People already looking to members of Congress. I think Patrick Murphy, congressman on the Democratic side, is already going to get in. There's some possibility that David Jolly, a congressman on the Republican side, will get in. There's going to be a long list of possibilities for that seat, which Mr. Rubio is giving up to run for the White House.
And then a Democrat retiring, Harry Reid, we've talked about that some already. That's another seat that's going to be in play, might have been in play even if Harry Reid ran again, though.
Right, and this is the thing. Remember that we talked about this before. I think the Republicans were at a disadvantage going into the 2016 field in the Senate because there's a bunch of Republicans who were elected in 2010, like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, for instance, in states that traditionally lean towards Democrats, particularly in presidential years. So it looked like those would be hard seats for the Republicans to hold. Well, now, you know, Harry Reid steps down in Nevada. That's a very competitive seat that the Democrats might not win. There's some possibility in West Virginia. Joe Manchin might step down and run for governor, another Democratic seat that might be available to Republicans. But now Democrats can say, oh, look, the Rubio seat in Florida, that's when we can win. So it's going to be a fun year, even at the congressional level, not necessarily just presidential.
Paul, thanks as always.
Of course, Rob. Looking forward to talking to you again.
That's USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to break down the latest from Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. For a lot of college and university hopefuls in the admission process, the good news or bad news has already arrived, and it's time to pick a school, start making plans. But for people trying to get into the university seen as elite, high-prestige institutions, the letter may still be in the mail.
But when it comes down to it, does it really matter? Does going to the most prestigious possible school make a positive difference in life, in a career? Recent pieces in Time, The Washington Post, and elsewhere have made the case that no, it doesn't matter where you go to school.
Well, our next guest says it's a little more complicated than that, and he digs into the issue in a recent piece we've linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Well, Derek, in your piece, you're kind of responding to arguments out there that say it doesn't matter where you go to college. It's a comforting sentiment, one that people want to hear. The argument being that graduates of elite schools don't really do better in the long run than people at other colleges. But you don't quite buy into that. Why not?
Well, I think there's two major points that I want to be clear about. The first point is that I do think that the mania surrounding what college smart 17 and 18-year-old kids go to, the mania is real, and the mania is overblown. That said, it does matter where you go to college, plain and simple. You look at the data, and graduates of the most prestigious colleges tend to earn more than graduates of less select public universities. Those graduates of four-year universities at any level are more likely to be employed, to have jobs, than graduates of two-year community schools. And those graduates of two-year community schools fare better in the labor force than people who just graduate from an online university or don't go to college at all. So you see that there is real stratification in this in the enormous collection of colleges that we have here in the United States. And so I don't think that the best, most empirical message for young people and for families is simply the name on your degree does not matter at all. Everything that we have suggests, of course, where you go to college, going to an elite school will, you know, in the long run and in the aggregate, have a different outcome than a graduate simply going to a online university that employers haven't heard of.
But on the other hand, you say that people who get rejected from the university of their choice, maybe an elite university, maybe someone's holding that rejection letter in their hand right now, you say they shouldn't be too crushed by that. So why not, given what you just said?
Right. So this goes back to one of my favorite studies about education and outcomes. And you have two economists, Stacey Berg Dale and Alan Krueger. And what they did essentially is they looked at students who attended really selective colleges. And then they compared them with students of seemingly comparable ability. All right. So similar SAT scores, similar grades, who attended less selective colleges. So you're essentially taking a look at the people who apply to, I don't know, let's say, I went to Northwestern. Let's say, you know, Northwestern or the University of Chicago. You're comparing the people that applied to and got into those schools with the people who were basically just as good by SAT and grade and extracurriculars but didn't get into those schools. How did those outcomes compare? And what they found is that they fared really, really similarly. And so the lesson that I draw from this is that where you go to school is a really good indication of the person you're becoming when you turn 17 or 18. There's all sorts of really interesting developmental psychology studies that look at how habit formation in your teen and early 20 years dictate habits through the rest of your life. So the more precise, empirical, and perhaps inspirational message for young people applying to school, anxiously waiting for that envelope, and their parents and their friends and their uncles is, the person who you're most likely to become is actually sort of already baked in. It's the product of all the hard work that you've already done, and it's not so much the product of the name of the school that says yes this week or next week. So in that sense, I think it's more sensible to say, yes, of course, you know, where you go to school matters, but it only matters because, generally speaking, where you go to school is an indication of the person who you are becoming.
Do we have a handle at all on what are the best predictors of future success? If you take out the college thing and look at the people that 17, 18-year-olds are at that point, what measures can we use to look at that?
Well, there's a lot of interesting and fairly good measures of future success. The type of school you go to is certainly one of them. Habits that you form is another. Besides these sort of broad traits or variables, though, it's really difficult to predict success. There's been a lot of wonderful pieces written precisely about the difficulty of predicting success. And, you know, one way that I think about it, because I'm a sports fan, you look at the college, at the NFL draft that's coming up in the next few weeks. I believe it's 2.5 weeks away that the NFL is going to draft its next batch of rookies. We all know people, great players like, say, Peyton Manning, who were drafted number one and went on to have wonderful careers. We also know busts, who were drafted number one or number two, who went on to do very little. And then we also know about Tom Brady's and Russell Wilson's out there, who were drafted really late by a bunch of experts, but nonetheless have turned into some of the best players in NFL history. I think sort of analogously about this situation, and I think, you know, what does it tell us about success? I think what it tells us about success is that there's only so much that you can predict with a high degree of certainty when someone is just 18 or 22, when you're looking at who that person's going to be when they're 29, 35, 45. A lot of what makes someone like, you know, Russell Wilson or Tom Brady end up becoming better than, you know, most of the number one picks in NFL history is that they work really hard. And so grit and hard work and resilience and stick-to-itiveness and all these terms that are really hard to measure empirically clearly have enormous sway in the outcome of professional athletes. We have great record of that. And then obviously for the rest of us as well.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, talking about college prestige and future success in work and in life. Now, Derek, one thing we might wonder is if we're going to that higher prestige school, that elite school, are we going to get a better education? Is more information going to be beamed into our brains as a result, or is that too hard to measure?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite things to think about. What's the right way to measure whether a college is good? And I think the reason that it's really difficult to measure the specific educational quality of elite schools is that elite schools aren't taking some random sample of high school students and churning out success stories over and over. Instead, they're accepting people who are often already on the road to success, connecting them with other people who are just like them and with an alumni network of workers who are successful as well, and then giving them a degree that signals to other employers, hey, this person has the potential to be incredibly successful in the future. So, you know, a college isn't just, a university is not just an education. It's an education, it's a network, both the peers in your class and with alumni who have graduated. And finally, number three, it's a signal. Harvard sends a very specific signal that University of Phoenix cannot send, even if someone at the University of Phoenix gets the exact same quality, quote-unquote, education as someone at Harvard. The reason that it's so difficult to measure is because it's so difficult to tease out these three effects: quality of education, quality of network, and quality of signal. A great university has all three.
We're talking right now with Derek Thompson about his recent piece in The Atlantic about how much it matters for students to attend the best possible university as people hoping to get into some of the country's most prestigious institutions wait for those admissions letters.
We want to hear your thoughts and your stories. Looking back, how much did your choice of whether to attend college and where to go affect your life? If you could go back and do it differently, what would you do? And if you or someone in your family is on the road to college now or in the next couple of years, what factors are you considering? Where did you apply and why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, talking about college and his recent piece in The Atlantic called It Doesn't Matter Where You Go to College, Inspirational but Wrong.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Does a higher prestige college lead to better jobs, more satisfaction at work, a happier life? Or is it down to the individual, what they make of their education, whatever it might be? And you could share your story, too, if you do it differently, if you had a chance to do it again. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Matt on the line in Sparta. Matt, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm currently on my fourth UW system college, and I can definitely say that the one I'm at now, which is generally considered more rigorous, harder to get into, probably more prestigious, is more difficult than the other three in one of the science programs, and the professors' expectations are higher. I'd say that the level of education, the quality of education is probably higher, and especially the science labs are more involved and more difficult. And I feel like I'll probably be more prepared because of the UW school that I'm at right now, as opposed to the three that I have been at previously. So I think it probably does matter to some extent.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting point. Maybe a higher prestige, higher expectations, and thus higher quality, Derek.
Yeah, it's possible. You know, one of the most compelling stats I didn't have a chance to mention earlier is that there was a study looking at the number of billionaires and Forbes' most powerful people and what share of them went to the most elite schools in the country. And it turned out that it 44.8% of billionaires, 56% of Forbes' most powerful women, and 85% of Forbes' most powerful men went to the same small group of elite schools. And so it's difficult to look at the sort of the concentration of both power and wealth going to graduates of the same small number of colleges and assuming that the college doesn't matter at all in terms of outcomes. Obviously, this is not just because of the better education afforded by these universities, but also because of networks and, again, that powerful signal that the most prestigious schools also have.
Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to move on to Lorenzo joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Lorenzo.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
I think that there was a question asked by the host earlier that kind of got an inadequate response, that question being, what do all the 17 and 18-year-olds have in common that might help us learn where they might land? And I think you talked about, in your sports analogy, that they have these hard work ethics and these grit and this determination. And I think it kind of is untrue. I think it's a very narrow look at what these students might have in common. Is there anything showing what socioeconomic factors they may have in common that account for the fact that maybe they do have similar outcomes, not so much because of their individual attributes, but more so what they all had in common before we even begin measuring the individual attributes? I think that would be more telling and lead us to really see where they would end up eventually. However, I think this conversation is a bit, you know, upsetting because it is not inclusive of students who will work really hard and who do have grit at the age of 17 and 18 and who could never even probably apply to an Ivy League school or think that.
Lorenzo, thanks a lot for joining us or for asking that question. And Derek, this is something you've thought some about yourself in terms of people who get left out of this conversation, who don't come from the privileged socioeconomic backgrounds that can go to this handful of elite schools. What about qualities they have in broadening the conversation to bridge that gap?
I think this is such a great question. When we talk about the mania around prestigious schools, the most important place to begin, I think, is to say that elite colleges aren't normal. This is a problem for 3% of 17 and 18-year-olds, worrying about which prestigious school am I going to get into. There's 4 million 18-year-olds in the U.S. Most of them, about 3.5 million of them, will go to college, but only a tiny sliver of them are worried about the response they're going to get from Princeton and the University of Wisconsin and Northwestern. So, more broadly speaking, I think the caller was really interested in asking a question about, I guess, what economists would call inputs. There is a lot of evidence that shows that economic opportunity is not evenly spread across the country. It is concentrated on the coasts. It's concentrated by ethnicity. It's clear that, whites have different opportunities than blacks and Hispanics for a host of reasons that span history and culture. And then also that, just wealth itself tends to promote wealth. And rich parents spend a lot of their money making sure that their children have the same opportunities that they did. And this is completely fine and adequate to love your child a lot, but that creates a kind of cumulative advantage standpoint where the rich can tend to get richer. So in no way was I trying to suggest that the secret to success is hard work, and anyone who works hard ipso facto becomes rich. I think that's obviously not true. There are people who don't work hard who become rich and people who work extremely hard who don't. I was responding more to the specific question of how do you predict success, which I think is difficult. But obviously there are a lot of historical problems in the country, whether it's divisions by race or wealth or geography, that are not going to be solved by one generation of people going to college, and that's definitely something to think about.
Talking to Derek Thompson about college, future success, and opportunity. And Derek, before we move along, you'd written in the past making the case that opportunities to get into prestigious universities should be expanded to include more people from low-income backgrounds in particular.
What would be the change? Well, a lot of prestigious colleges are extremely good at looking to elite schools and taking their best and brightest, most interesting students. They're not as good at casting their eye towards lower income communities that don't often send people to, say, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, et cetera, to find the best and brightest there. So what you have essentially is this discovery problem. How do you find extremely smart and promising low income people living in areas that don't typically send their 18-year-olds to Harvard? Solving this question and advancing the benefits of a Harvard's education and network and signal to these lower-income students, that would be even more valuable, I think, than bestowing those same gifts on an otherwise privileged youngster.
Derek, how do you think the conversation that we're having right now relates to a broader conversation that's been increasingly going on about whether college is still worth it for a lot of people in terms of the cost, the student debt load, and whether the amount of work and financial input equates to, a better job, more money down the road at all? Increasingly, like, that question is one that people are trying to get a handle on, whether college pays off.
Right. This is an extremely complicated issue that has lots of exceptions. And whenever you make one generalization, you can always have somebody say, no, but that's not true for this person. But the the generalizations that nonetheless seem to be true are the following. People who graduate from college tend to handle their student debt better than people who drop out of college. People who graduate from master's programs and professional degree programs, even though they have more debt, are often less likely to default than even people who dropped out earlier on. And people who have four-year degrees and master's degrees and professional degrees are almost all employed at higher rates than people who just go to community college or people who don't go to college at all. There is not a lot of empirical evidence that suggests that the typical person weighing the benefits of college is better off not going. Just about all the evidence I've seen suggests that that marginal person should get a college degree. Unfortunately, for lots of reasons, including budget cuts and the growth of administrative hires, college is much more expensive than it used to be, and it is growing. The price of it is growing much faster than wages. And so it is more expensive than it used to be, but it's also extremely important. And when you compare the wages of college graduates to people who don't go to college, this is the so-called college premium. It is not at an all-time high, but it is dang near close to an all-time high. There is not a lot of evidence that says that people should not go to college.
Derek, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. His piece on college is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You can head on over and keep the conversation going over there. Tell us your story. Tell us about the choices you made and how you think they paid out if you do the same thing over again when it comes to your decisions about college. Some news now from space. According to data collected from the Curiosity rover, it looks like Mars may have small amounts of water on its surface, under the right conditions anyhow.
Now, it's nothing you could drink. It's being described as briny water, and it's not enough to splash around in. This is just condensation of vapor on a salty soil during the Martian night. But this would be apparently the first sign of liquid water on the surface on present-day Mars.
It's another piece of the puzzle in trying to find out if Mars could have supported life in the past and maybe if it could in the future with potential human colonization somewhere down the road there.
Yeah, there are plans afoot. They're signing up names, taking names for people to be the first people to make a one-way trip, no return to Mars. I guess a hint here that there might be a little bit of water that's tappable down the road.
Life wants water, right? You need to have water in some form if you're gonna go to Mars.
Right, and I guess a NASA leader was saying they expect to see a life discovered outside of Earth in the next 10 to 20 years.
So
we could be alive to maybe hear the news of extrasolar life. Crazy.
It is crazy. And I'm still not sure you should have signed up to go to Mars. The show is only 2 years old.
Well, yeah, but it was just a guy selling tickets on a corner. I don't think they can hold me to that. Anyhow, we're going to go to the news with Gustav Holst and Mars, bringer of war, or bringer of water, here on Central Time.